Now, you know, I was lucky enough to have been in relationships, you know, with outside of my race that parents and things like that didn't really give anybody a hard time or say anything to me. You know, so I haven't had to experience those type of things, but there are people out there who have to experience those things and come to grips with the fact that, oh crap, my dad's a little racist. Like, you know, or oh crap, my mom's a little racist, white or black. Because I can tell you a bunch of times where, you know, somebody's mom, you know, who's black is like, you better not bring a white girl home. That's racist. That's racist too. Like it is. Okay. Like we always say, oh, black people, it's okay. But no, that's racist too. You know, like the book Dear Martin that you were, you know, we were trying to get going that you had brought up and all that stuff. Man, if you the experiences that Justice goes through basically is my entire like arc as a teenager, young adult, learning and growing. Every single one of the experiences that he goes through, I've had happen to me in some shape or form. If not the exact same thing in the exact same way, but all of those things have happened. And I thought it was such a good story, a good book, a good point made, because I know if I read that book in high school, I would have been all over it because I was going through those same things. I was going through the questioning of who I am. What am I supposed to be? How am I supposed to act? Is it okay to be this way? Is it okay to carry myself that way? Is it okay not to be true to myself? Is it okay, you know, do I have to hide who I am? All those type of things were brought up in that book, and I thought it was really good in that because I know there are kids, you know, our students, you know, who are struggling with, if not all of those things, a lot of those things and question those things. It's part of growing up where you have to question, am I doing the right, like, who am I? You know, and that book I thought did a lot of that questioning of who am I? I would have liked to seen it be longer, to be honest with you, to really delve into a lot of
Well, she's making a sequel.
She is?
It's Dear Just yeah, it's called Dear
Oh,
Justice.
wow. So,
Yeah, so well, it'll be from his
okay.
perspective.
That I think that's awesome, man.
Like totally.
Let me know when it's out. I'll look it up and pre-order it. Because
Yeah,
I
this fall, I think it's like September or October it's supposed to be coming out.
awesome.
Yeah, soon. If you haven't read Dear Martin, if you're listening, read Dear Martin. I really, really, really wanted that to be our one book, one school summer reading, but it just didn't pan out this year. But maybe next year it'll be Dear Justice that we'll have to read Dear Martin too. But I think that it's such a valid point in that book where he is questioning, am I going against who I am in my black community by doing X, Y, and Z? And I think I can think of one instance in my mind, I won't name the student, but if they're listening, they probably know who it is. And hit the persona that he projected in school was not who that person was. And I only knew that because I got to read his writing and read his journals and read his thoughts when no one else was listening. But because he needed to be perceived a certain way to his peers, he was being perceived to the adults in the school as someone that he, in his heart, was not. But that perception of him, I'm being pulled in these two directions here, and I don't know which direction I should go in because he's 16 or 17, and who knows who they are when they're that age. But that book definitely is so good and highly, highly recommend. We can actually, before we get into the education thing, I did want to say, and this it goes right into that. Do you ever feel guilty because of your success?
Do I feel guilty?
And whether that be to your like to the black community because you do see so many African Americans suffering, or whether that's educators in general, like do you feel guilty?
I'll say this, that, you know, again, I'm gonna play my age here. You know, the fact that I'm 40, I'm finally, I would say, in the last maybe like 5 years or so, 4 years or so, completely comfortable in who I am, I would say. And with that comfortability, with age and a little perspective, I have begun to realize, well, not begun to realize, I currently realize that this is me, man. This is me. The way I live my life does not pertain to you. I'm not doing anything harmful to you. I'm not doing anything, you know, malicious to you. I'm not a malicious person. So, you know, I'm always completely comfortable with the decisions I'm making because I know I'm making them from a place of good, of right, of the greater good of everyone. And I know I'm not being malicious. And had you asked me this question in my 20s, it would be a much different answer. A much different answer, because I would say, like, again, if I go back through my history, through my lifetime, in the 90s, I struggled with, you know, am I supposed to like Public Enemy, or am I allowed to like, you know, these songs, or, you know, am I supposed to listen to rap because I'm black, so I have to listen to rap, I should know all the rappers, and when I don't know all the rappers and this kid knows the rappers, I feel a certain type of way, or, you know, I have to dress this way, I have to wear this, I have to wear that. And back then, like I said, it was Public Enemy, it was Jordans, it was, you know, Too Black, Too Strong t-shirts and things like that after the Rodney King thing. And there was a very pro-black movement again, not like the civil rights movement in the 60s, but a small, you know, 30 years later, pro-black movement, Malcolm X hacks. And you have to read the autobiography of Malcolm X. So I went through that and trying to identify myself as black, because I had to identify myself as black at that point. To in my 20s, you know, and in my late teens, trying to figure out, all right, how am I setting myself up for success later on in life? What am I going to do? What's my job going to be? What, I got to get to college. I got to do this. I have to do that, and blah, blah, blah. And so the fear of the race thing went away, and it turned into more of a goal-oriented part of my life, where I was trying to set myself up to be able to be a good citizen, you know, that has a job, that is contributing to society, and what does that look like? What does that mean for me? What am I going to do for the rest of my life, you know, kind of thing. To around, you know, the end of my undergrad studies and into grad school, I had, and people will not believe this, the longest cornrows ever that you have seen. And
pictures.
Yeah, if I could find some pictures, thank God there was no cell phones back then like that had, you know, had the memory to keep all those pictures. But legitimately, you pulled my hair down in the front, it went down to my chest. That's how long my hair was. My hang time in the back, woo, was midway down my back. It was crazy. Like, so I went through that phase where I'm in my 20s, and I'm from New Jersey, and I'm down in Tallahassee, and y'all don't know me, and I'm tough. Like, you don't know who I am. Like, don't act like that. Don't come to me with that mess. Like, I went through that phase, you know, of, you know, this is all during the early 2000s, Allen Iverson and all. Like, I was proud. Like, I can't tell you, I was proud to be from Philly. You know, I was proud to be from this area. I was proud to be from the Northeast. I was proud to carry myself like that. You know, like, it was just, you know, everybody was rocking Air Force Ones at the time again. Like, you know, we had them when we were little. They were Uptowns, and they cost like $50. But now they were back. I knew all about them. And no, y'all don't know nothing about these, you know, these ones, these Uptowns. Y'all don't know anything about them. So being, you know, that was a different phase. And I would say then I was trying to not fit in again, but just rediscovering what blackness was and what it meant for me to be black and, you know, who I was supposed to be at that point. To now, again, this is 20 years later, I'm an assistant principal, I have kids, I'm a father, I'm a husband, there are different priorities in my life right now, and I'm completely comfortable in who I am in terms of my decision making, why I'm doing what I'm doing, and what I'm actually trying to accomplish. So I would say with that, you know, now, no, I don't feel, you know, guilty for success. I acknowledge the people that helped me. I acknowledge how I got here. I acknowledge, you know, all the markers along the way, but I don't feel guilty. I feel, if anything, proud that, you know, this is a kid that had every reason when he was in high school to do something stupid, to do the wrong thing, to you know, everyone would have made an excuse for me and said, oh, well, his dad just died, or, oh, it's not really his fault. He's going through a hard time. And I didn't do that. You know, I chose to do the other thing. I chose to live like my dad wanted me to live. You know, I chose to do the right thing like my mom taught me to do, you know, like my grandparents taught me to do, and all those people who came before me who expected me to do something greater, you know, and I'm going to have those same expectations for my kids, you know, like guys, there's going to be tough times. Bad things are going to happen. You know, I was talking to my wife last night. This is 30 years after, you know, roughly 30 years after Rodney King and 30 years before Rodney King was civil rights. You know, like, there's going to be tough times, man. There's going to be tough times. You're going to have to face some strife. You're going to have to man up, woman up, to, you know, like, whatever you want to call it, to get through life. But at the end, you can't quit, man. You can't quit. And if there's anything that I wish the kids in the schools learn from me is that you don't give up. You don't accept your circumstance. You can change your circumstance. You can't control the things that are out of your control. And I tell the kids this all the time. I'm like, look, man, you guys have – God knows what's going on at home. And I've heard some horror stories from some of these kids, horror stories, and, you know, guts me. And they can't change that. They can't change those circumstances. What they can change is what they do. You do what you can do to make yourself successful. You do what you can do to help your situation as much as you can. Because if you do that, you're not giving up on yourself. But when you give up on yourself, when you give up that control of your life, it's over. You're not going to make it. And it's hard to get it back. But if you actually control what you can control, you can do some great things, and you can get to a point in your life that you didn't see when you were 15, that you didn't see when you were, you know, 16, or that you didn't even fathom you would be and how happy you could be with what you have, you know, by the time you're 40.
Mic drop.
Yeah. Boom. Before I was going to ask, which is, what are your thoughts and feelings on being one of the only three African-American educators in the building? So it's you, Alexis, and Alaya. And then Roxanne does attendance, and she's there as well. But the three educators in the building, and Roxanne educates the students in other ways. Personally, I think she helps a lot of them in personal ways. But in the classroom or in an office, what are your thoughts?
Don't forget about Mr. Somerville. You have Alonzo, who unfortunately will be leaving Overbrook, but when you think of the four, you know, who, like, teaching full on, always will, interacting with the students
that have been a teacher in the educational form. Yes, I, again, something that ever since I moved from Camden, I've dealt with in my life, being one of five black students, being one of, you know, the only black student in the class, being, you know, like, it's always that way. The only black kid on the team, you know.
Why do you think that there isn't as much diversity in education? Why aren't so many African Americans, I don't know, are they not being interviewed? Or are they not going into education? Like, where's the disconnect? Because I know so many African Americans that could be great teachers, but don't go for it. And I don't know.
My personal reason why I went for it was my mom. My mom was a teacher, Camden City Schools, special education teacher. She was a reading specialist, and ended up moving up through administration a little bit as well to be a supervisor. So that's kind of what my path was laid out for. Like, and I had the conversation, my mom, who was a teacher, telling me, Reem, I don't want you to be just a teacher. You know, even someone who was a teacher saying that to me, like, I and that was in high school. And I'm like, well, you know, being a teacher is good. Like, you have, but it was born out of her want for me to do more. And the perception of do more was that you go be a doctor, you go be a lawyer, you go do something like that. And again, you know, you don't want to waste intelligence, not saying that teaching is a waste of intelligence. But it was that perception.
I had a teacher tell me that once, that I was wasting my intelligence by going into education. She pulled me after class, stopped me, wanted to talk to me. It was my last year of school, to tell me that I was wasting my potential on being a teacher. And I was just like, what do I say to that?
Exactly.
Thank you. I don't know.
and we have to go and look at what success means.
This was a teacher telling me that.
Again, my mom said that to me. Yeah. And again, like, the idea of success is that, you know, people say things like that about education because you're not going to make a lot of money. You're not going to do that. Like, the status of a teacher is not as high as some other professions. Like, if you tell somebody you're a doctor, they're like, oh, well, you're a doctor. And again, immediately they think you're smart. You're a doctor. Oh, you're smart. You're a teacher. No, I don't like my kid's teacher. Or they themselves had a bad time in high school or in middle school or elementary school and had a bad teacher or somebody who they didn't get along with. So they're like, oh, teachers stink. I don't like teachers. You know, it's that same thing. So I think in hiring practices, and I'm now on that side of things, I would say it's not a conscious thing that, you know, you look for a certain race or a certain type or you discard. I've never discarded a resume because of someone's name and I'm like, oh, no. I've discarded a resume because of the formatting and I'm like, oh, that's terrible. I don't care what name that is. What is this? Like, I've definitely done that. Now, does that mean that maybe some, you know, black people or people didn't have access to how to write a resume the right way? Yes, that's possible. They've been disadvantaged that way. They didn't have a parent who knew what to put on their resume to say, no, you're going for this job. You want to highlight this or you want to say it this way. Yes. And again, I had privilege that way where my first job that I got, I definitely did not get it from just putting an interview in, resume, blah, blah, blah. I got it because my mom worked in the district and knew somebody that was looking for a teacher. And she was like, you should apply and talk to the person. And they gave me an interview. Now, from there, I did what I did, you know. But my foot in the door was for my mom, you know. So I don't know if necessarily, you know, it is a disproportionate amount of people who don't have that ability to get the foot in the door. For people of color, you know, for African Americans, for black people, I would say that definitely is there, where they don't have the chance to get the foot in the door the same way. Now, when we're hiring, when we're interviewing, I'm looking for certain things when I'm talking to somebody. If you don't present the way that I think you need to present in the interview, then that doesn't matter who you are. Again, that doesn't matter. Is there a problem? I would say there's a problem for the students. I would say that. I wouldn't say that there's a problem. It's not a problem that there's a certain amount of black people in school who are in these positions and this and that. That's not the problem. The problem is for the students, and they're being educated generally by people who don't look like them, by people they don't relate to, by people they don't necessarily understand, or they have an implicit bias against. Okay.
Is there an added pressure on you because you're one of the only African Americans in the building? Do you feel an added pressure, whether that's to other staff members or to other students?
I, you know, the added pressure I have and the added pressure I feel like I can't speak up on certain issues that I want to speak up on because people, it'll turn certain people off to think that I'm using race all the time. And they're like, oh, he's all about race. So for me to get my point across, I don't want to sound like I'm about race all the time. I don't want to sound like I'm the voice, you know, that everyone needs to come to when there's a racial issue and things like that, because I feel like the other things that I have to say that may be more pressing aren't going to get heard. But I definitely feel that pressure when something like this is going on that, like, again, I don't talk, I don't speak, I don't really tell people a lot about myself. And for me to be open like this, it is pretty tough for me. But I felt like there needs to be someone saying these things. And the reason I feel like there needs to be someone saying these things is because it doesn't just happen to criminals. It doesn't just happen to the bad people. It doesn't just happen to someone who's doing something wrong. I've had instances in which I've done nothing wrong and I'm one of the good ones. You know, I'm one you can trust. I'm not I'm not like everyone else, you know, because that's another one I hear all the time. You're not like, it happens to me too. And the only reason it's happening to me is because of the color of my skin. So I do feel the need to speak up on certain things. I do feel a connection with certain issues, especially things of, you know, equality and all these other things that, you know, as a district, as, you know, in education that we talk about, you know, trauma informed and being, you know, all those things, because you don't know where someone's coming from. And because of these implicit biases that we have and our own privilege, sometimes we can't see it. So I feel the need to sometimes call attention to it, you know, being a Black man and someone who I think has earned the respect and earned the trust at this point that people would really listen to what I have to say. So I do feel that pressure in both senses, that I don't want to speak up all the time. Yes, that there are times where I do want to speak up.
Yeah.
Do you feel the pressure as well?
Yeah. My automatic response was yes. Because being, and I think that this is probably maybe the difference as well between Mr. Fisher and myself, Ms. Banners. Mr. Fisher's the administrator in the building, and I'm the teacher. So my relationship and my rapport with a lot of our students is going to be a little bit different. And so, you know, you have Ms. Braxton, who's a guidance counselor, and then you have Ms. Roxanne, but then being the only female Black teacher in the building, like, whoa. And I think I didn't necessarily feel so much of that until we went and took African American Culture Club and some other students to see the movie Just Mercy. And then, you know, there's such a great discussion during Just Mercy, and there was not enough time to unpack everything that was in the movie and that was discussed after the movie. And then having, you know, to continue to talk to the students about some of those issues that came up and some of their, them processing the issues after the fact. Like, you know, they were coming to me and they were stopping me in the hallway and they were stopping me in the library. And, you know, it became difficult because it was, you felt like you had to have the conversation because there's no one else for them to have the conversation with. You know, it couldn't be like, look, I have to run, or like, you have to get to class so you're not late. Go, let's, you know, if you can't catch me, go catch so-and-so. There isn't always that other option.
There isn't a so-and-so.
So I feel like sometimes, you know, and this is in every grade, teachers spend so much time with their students that the students look at them as, you know, sometimes they're calling you, you know, my school mom or this or that. And I feel like I'm that figure to so many of our students, which is phenomenal. And if any students listening to this, I'm not saying don't come to my room. But there definitely is that added pressure because, you know, Ms. Braxton's the guidance counselor, Mr. Fisher's the administrator. So being that teacher and being in the classroom in that way, there's definitely that pressure. And sometimes it's great, and other times, you know, I have crumbled under feeling like I need to hold myself in a certain way, or conversations I've had with other staff members who don't understand why I have to have these conversations, but they have to be had. And so there's definitely a lot of different pieces when from being in that situation, for sure.
And that goes back to your original part of the question, Melissa, about, you know, the issue with not having a more diverse staff. Mm-hmm. Is that, you know, you're left.
And I'm not knocking the staff.
No, at all.
I love our staff.
And I think what's been about this podcast is, so many staff members have reached out and said, thank you for that podcast. Thank you for showing me how to have that conversation in some way. Because I think that's potentially the other piece of it is we have, like, and I'll tell this to anybody who asks me, one of the main reasons I love working at Overbrook is because of the people that I work with. I never feel less than, I never feel like an outcast because I'm one of the only minorities in the building. Like, people are, staff love on you and they want to help you no matter what. So when they hear this podcast, so many of their responses have been, you know, how can I, or So many of their responses have been, I've always wanted to have this conversation, but I wasn't sure if I could, or I didn't know how to. And I think that that's such an amazing response because they're willing to learn and they're willing to grow and they want to continue to make the school better for all of the kids, no matter what their race or no matter what their background is. So I think, again, we're totally not knocking the staff that, are not working with more black teachers, but would it be nice for the kids' piece of it of having and the representation piece? Yes. That's the one thing I miss or I wish for.
And that's what I was kind of, sorry, that's what I was kind of saying, that, unfortunately, it's easier to build rapport sometimes with someone who looks like you because you feel as though they have shared experiences. There's nothing wrong with that. That's just, innate in our in us. But you build a rapport, and that means, like you were saying, instead of you building rapport with 10 students, sometimes you have to build that rapport with 40 students because they're like, oh, I'm gonna go talk to Miss Banner about this, And like you said, the difference between me and you is that less people are gonna come talk to me just because of my position. I'm such a fun-loving guy. But less people are gonna, the students are less likely to come to me because I'm considered on a different level even than just you. So it's harder for them to come talk to me. Now, the ones that do come talk to me, I think they find that it's a lot more introspective than they thought it was going to be, or they get an answer that they're like, wow, oh my God, but they're less likely to come to me, which takes yet another person out of the game, So it more falls onto our staff members, and, even other staff members may be less likely to want to approach you about, well, how do you have this conversation or this, because there are less minorities on staff. If maybe they would vibe better with a different minority and be able to have that conversation and say, oh, okay, well, what's, and just talk. It's just, the less people there are, there's a less chance for change and a less chance for, getting the message that we need to get out there or making people feel the way they should feel.
So you hear that, kids, go talk to Mr. Fisher's door is wide open.
Do not.
I have heard firsthand experience students coming back from write-ups being like, wow, I didn't know Mr. Fisher was like that. And then somebody else would be like, yeah, he's a pretty cool guy when you get to know him. So his
You
door
are
is wide
making
open.
that up. No one has ever said that.
That conversation happened in my fourth period this year.
No, that is not a true story.
I don't know if you remember, Alexis, when you asked me, like, it was one of the last times we were hanging out, and you asked me when was the first time, or you saw a Twitter post about when was the first time that you ever had an African American teacher, and I have never had an African American
Wow.
teacher.
Yeah.
So just
And I
curious.
was telling Melissa, like, it was literally the Tuesday that school closed. I went over to Melissa's. We were just like hanging out and we were talking about this. And I really had to sit there and rack my brain around when I had my first black teacher. And it was my middle school music teacher, Miss Parmentier, but you only had her for a marking period. So, it wasn't like an academic subject. And then it really, and still, I'm like trying to see if I can correct myself, but it really wasn't until college, probably my sophomore, junior year, they had a African American female adjunct professor. And I loved her. I thought she was phenomenal because I was like, wow, there's someone who is like into history, is well educated, who looks like me. And I loved the class. It's the I think the highest grade I received in my 4 years of undergrad because I just loved her class so much. Because I felt represented. I felt like comfortable talking to her because I thought she could get me and understand me. And it was amazing, yeah. But it really wasn't until my sophomore year of college I had that was a teacher. Now in high school, there were African American administrators, but they weren't my teacher. And the main African American administrator principal called all of the minorities into the theater to tell us that we weren't taking high-level classes and that we needed to take higher-level classes and try to go more into apply for National Honor Society. And I was in two honors-level classes. I was sitting next to my friend who was in AP chemistry, and it was, you know, it became a stink. Like, my mom called the school because it put this target on the African American and Latino students saying, you know, you don't work hard enough. You need to be better. And I think he was coming from a good, trying to come from a good place and trying to motivate us because he knew his teaching staff, there wasn't anyone that looked like us. But it still wasn't very well thought out. But yeah, so it really wasn't until, again, college that I really had an African-American teacher.
Mr. Fisher, do you remember your first African-American teacher?
In kindergarten, Miss Monk.
Wow.
She was a black lady. And then, so that's easy for me to find that one. There was the aide in Miss Roller's class, my preschool. She was black as well. I'm just going back.
Who remembers their preschool teachers?
So, well, back then in Camden, preschool was part of the school. It was all Forest Hill Elementary. So preschool you went to, and then you went to kindergarten. It was all in the school. But here's the thing. So I can give you those two off the top of my head, right? Mm-hmm. I didn't have another black teacher, I don't think, in anything since kindergarten. Now, there's been black teachers in the school, and, you know, I've had black coaches and things like that. But teacher-wise, I'm like, I'm going back through every grade. And second grade, no. Third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, no. Sixth grade, we switched classes, no. Seventh grade, we switched classes. No. Eighth grade, no. And then in high school, no. I don't believe so. Trying to go through my math teachers all right now in high school.
And it's crazy.
English.
I sat there for like the same amount of time. I really did. I was just like, whoa.
Yeah, that's actually pretty crazy. And then even college. No. Now, there were, like I said, there were black teachers in the school. I had, in middle school, our principal was black, Mr. Brown. He was black. So, did have a black administrator. But other than that, maybe my elementary school principal might have been black as well. Mm. But other than that, I had Ms. Von Hammond, but I'm pretty sure she was there. And that was first grade. I don't know.
It's crazy.
In karate, my Sabu Nim, the guy who ran the school, he was black.
He was a sensei.
Well, he was like a sensei, but it was Sabu Nim. He was black. So
sorry.
Don't disrespect me that way. No, but again, I think. I was lucky that in my young formative years, I did come into contact with that many, you know, African-American black educators. But then after that, no.
So right. To transition kind of as we were saying about our staff at Overbrook and them reaching out to thank Melissa and I for having this conversation and for creating this podcast and kind of opening that door that maybe some of them were uncomfortable to go through. What advice would you give to the staff? Because although being the African-American educators in the building, you and I, not every student feels comfortable coming to either one of us. So they're going to go a different staff member. So what advice would you give them in talking to students about some of these race issues that have risen now?
So again, I go back to the first thing that everyone has to do, and everyone, I mean myself included, has to look at themselves in the mirror and think about the times where we knew something wrong was happening and we didn't do anything. We didn't say anything. We didn't react. Because I know there have been many times, not, you know, not 100 times or anything like that, but there have been times I can think of in my head right now in which somebody said something slick, and because of where I was and who I was with, I was like, all right, I'm going to let that ride. I'm going to act like I didn't hear it. Because I don't want to make everyone else uncomfortable. There's been so many times in my life that I have made myself uncomfortable to make sure everyone else is not uncomfortable.
Wow.
To make sure I don't look like the angry black man. Absolutely. Okay. There have been times of that. So we have to all look at those times in our life when we were complicit. Because that's what all we were doing. We were being complicit. And being educators, being someone who knows how, you know, children work and how you, if they keep testing the cell phone policy, test, 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 and you don't write them up, what's going to happen? Cell phones are going to be rampant in your classroom. You're never going to get control of that again. If you keep enforcing it, enforcing it, enforcing it, enforcing it, and saying something and doing something about it, after the first month, cell phones aren't an issue in your class. Or if they pop it out and you look, they're like, whoop, I'm going to put that away. Okay? Because it's an expectation. So we have to look at ourselves at times we were complicit, either in an overtly racist situation or a subtly racist situation, and let it slide and didn't say anything. Because if we stop that in ourselves and don't allow that to go forward, like I said, if you fight it, fight it, fight it, fight it, it goes away. It becomes the new normal. And people have to do that first. Before they're ready to give advice, before they're ready to talk about things, they have to be honest with themselves there. Okay, and be better there. And I'm not saying you have to constantly and argue and yell at somebody, but we got to start calling some things out and saying, that's not okay. I'm offended. Yeah. That's not right. You shouldn't do that. Like, we can't talk. We can't do this. Unfollow, right. Whatever you got to do. The second thing I would say is that with any hard topic, and you're giving advice to someone, you have to approach it like that someone has not had any of your experiences. And what I mean by that, if we give advice to someone about what college they should go to, we give advice in a different way. We don't say, oh, you should go. I wouldn't say, oh, you should go to Florida State University because that's where I went. And these are the reasons that's great. I would say, well, what are you looking to study? Well, we ask questions first when we give advice to try to formulate something that's helpful, okay? You need to first listen to what that person's saying. You need to first listen to their experience. You need to first understand what that experience has done to them and how that experience has made them feel. And only then can you start to kind of understand before you start giving advice and this and that. You know, like that would be a misstep in my thought, that if you just assume you know, you assume you get it, you assume that this is terrible, and you assume that this is the experience they're going through. If you're doing that, then you're just as tone deaf, because you're not listening, you're not hearing the pain, you're not hearing what they really need from you. I think people can give good advice just like we would any other time when we ask questions, when we, you know, when we listen, when we try to empathize and know that regardless of what I can say and what I can do, I'm not going to change the experience you just went through. I'm not going to change these questions that you're having. You know, it's going to be an ongoing thing. But what I can do is try to listen, try to hear, and guide you in a way that's going to be positive for you, you know, in a way that you can have an outcome that you're okay with. I think those are two big things. But definitely first, we got to look ourselves in the mirror.
Yeah. I saw this like great analogy that someone was saying. And it said like, she's a Peloton instructor, and she really had this great ride, and it was called like a speak up ride. And she gave this great analogy about how she's African American. And she said, I can have a paper cut. Like, I could get that paper cut and you can look at me and say, and I'm screaming in pain and I'm saying it hurts so bad and you've never had a paper cut before and all you're doing is saying it can't hurt that bad. It can't be that bad. But you've never had a paper cut, so you wouldn't be able to understand the pain of that paper cut. So just listen how much the paper cut hurts and ask me how to help my pain of the paper cut instead of just saying it can't be that bad, or in the opposite end, assuming that it is something that it's not as well. Which I thought was a really clever analogy too.
To go with the paper cut analogy, I have a knife analogy that I heard that I was like, this is awesome. If I take a 10-inch knife, stab you in the back, right? You're going to be bleeding, you're going to be hurting, you're going to be damaged and all these other things, right? If I pull that 10-inch knife out 3 inches, we made progress, right? And you're healed now, right? Everything's all good, right?
No.
Yes? No?
Well, no. The knife is still there.
Oh, you mean the 7 inches of knife that's still in your back? Even though I pulled 3 inches out? All right, fine. You need a lot. You're really high maintenance. I'll pull another 6 inches out. You good?
No.
Why not? I've already done this. I pulled 90% of the knife out. 100%. Why are you whining? Back. Oh, because there's still something there. And you know what? Healing doesn't occur until I pull the entire knife out, until I address the damage that has been done by the knife internally, and until I treat that damage, does healing start. Healing isn't over. Healing starts after the knife is removed, after the damage has been assessed, and after something has been done to treat the damage. I think people have to really understand that 1619, right? 1619. Do the math, people. Do the math. 1 year, 2 years, we've made this much progress in 30 years. 1619, these things have been in place as a system to oppress, whether consciously or unconsciously. Mm-hmm. It's not all nefarious, but they've been there. And it's going to take a long time. I mean, you look at how Germany reconciled World War II. They teach it that they were like in schools. They're like, yeah, we did this bad stuff. Like, yeah, right. we really messed up here. Like, they teach their kids that. And we do not do that here, you know, and we teach the Holocaust. Everyone teaches the Holocaust. You know, but Germany teaches it differently than we do. They're like, yeah, we were responsible. We were complicit. We allowed this to happen. This was bad and it should have never happened and we shouldn't allow that and we can't ever go back to that, but it was our fault. We kind of need to get to that same place instead of saying, well, we've made it this far and, oh, well, we can have this, you know. This was 1950. I wouldn't be allowed to be married to my wife. My kids being alive would have been really bad. You know, we've made progress. We've moved some things. Things have changed, but there's still so much there that we can't even begin to assess the damage truly and start to treat the damage and heal.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher, for coming on to our podcast. And I think that this is kicking it off with a bang, and anyone to follow is just going to have to really live up to these high expectations that you've now set.
Real quick, I just want to say, like, I appreciate what you guys are doing. I appreciate you guys giving a voice to this. It even enlightened me to who you both were when I listened to the first podcast. And like I said, it articulated that I'm quite old in comparison. And I'm like, man, this and that. So it kind of even puts – in more perspective where our students are in relation to myself. But here's the one thing I would say to a teenager going through some things. Man, you do not understand that people have more shared experiences to you than you think. I had a conversation with my next door neighbor who's early 60s. I think he's 62. And we're going through some of our injustices that have been done to us. And he's like, yep, that happened to me. Yep, that happened to me. And we're going back and forth. And I'm like, I would have never guessed that we have lived so many of the same experiences, not exact same things, but the same experiences. So you don't have, you're not alone in this, you know, talk to someone. You don't need to carry around a burden of hate. I know sometimes it seems like you do, but you don't have to carry around a burden of hate. There are other people who you can talk to, learn from, and have them help guide you. Because I know I spend a lot of time being angry about things for a good part of my life, you know, and I wish I had someone to talk to during that time, mm-hmm. you know. So just keep that stuff in mind, man, and it's going to get better. It's going to get better. We're going to reevaluate. We're going to do some things, and we're going to change. We're going to change the world.